ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Thursday, the 5th of March. I'm Melissa Clark in Canberra, coming to you from Ngunnawal country and acknowledging other custodians. Australians who've been stranded for days in Dubai have arrived home safely on the first Australian flight out of the UAE since the US and Israeli strikes on Iran escalated into a region-wide conflict. More than 230 Australians arrived in Sydney on the Emirates flight, with another three flights scheduled to depart from the UAE today. Meanwhile, six DFAT crisis response teams have headed to the Middle East to help the thousands of Australians still stuck, as David Sparks reports.
Family and friends were thrilled as the exhausted but relieved group of repatriated Australians walked into view at Sydney Airport. Among them, 19 students from Barker College who'd been on their way to Turkey for a robotics competition.
We were stuck in Dubai for like 5 days. We were told not to go on our phones, try to conserve battery, but we were taken to a bunker underground, so we were pretty safe.
How scary was it?
Not that scary. I wasn't really thinking very clearly at the time because I was tired.
Travelling with the students was staff member Diane Becker and her one-year-old daughter, Clara.
It's really hard, right, to know what is going to happen. You need to be ready for anything, right? And it's not just about me, it's about the people that are around me as well. So it's complicated, right? But I think it's good that we were able to come back home.
Sam Brown was another arrival on the flight from Dubai, along with her four-year-old daughter. She was grateful to be reunited with her children.
We're in Dubai and we were separated from our teenagers. So, yeah, it's been a lot, but we're, absolutely, absolutely delighted. Absolutely delighted. So we recently moved to Dubai and, just totally shocked by the situation. It was just absolutely surreal. Absolutely surreal. We were in our house that we recently moved to, and I never thought I'd be in a situation where I heard explosions over my living room, you know, front door rattling kind of stuff. But the kids were great. We were in really good communication with them and we just couldn't believe we got on that flight. Yeah, so grateful.
Sam Brown's teenage daughter, Lila, was relieved to welcome her mum home.
I'm very happy and overjoyed. It's, a bit nervous this week at school and everything, but no, it's really nice to see everyone. Yeah.
At Melbourne Airport, triathlete Emma Carney was among the arrivals. She was working with the Saudi Triathlon Federation, coaching athletes in Bahrain when war broke out in Iran. She's grateful to be home.
You know when your plane's in turbulence and you hear a bit of a thud? When you hear a thud in a plane over a war zone, it's not a good feeling. That was the worst bit. So it all sort of kicked off on Friday and things got a little bit hectic. You could sort of hear. There were alarms and you could sort of tell that missiles were going off, we were evacuated.
Foreign Minister Penny Wong says more flights are coming in today.
I understand and I want to make sure I'm very careful about this because things can cancel at the last minute because we are talking about a conflict zone. But I understand there are three flights scheduled today from the UAE. So we are hoping, all of Australia is hoping, that those flights can depart safely.
And the minister is concerned about how the Middle East conflict is spreading.
Well, we know that the degrading of military assets is part of conflict, but I am concerned that the conflict is spreading so much. I am concerned, for example, that Iran is now seeking to strike Turkey, which is a NATO member. Now, the more this conflict spreads, the harder it will be for peace and stability to be resumed. And at some point, there has to be a return to diplomacy and dialogue for there to be stability.
The federal government is sending crisis response teams to the Middle East to help thousands of stranded Australians in the region. The first team is on its way, although the government won't say where it's going due to security concerns.
David Sparks reporting. The Trump administration appears still unclear on whether it's waging a military operation or a war on Iran. But whatever it is, the Pentagon claims it's winning. In a media briefing full of fighting talk, the Secretary of War said the regime was toast, and he gloated about the torpedoing of an Iranian warship in the Indian Ocean, with more than 80 sailors reportedly killed. And NATO air defences have shot down an Iranian ballistic missile as it headed towards Turkish airspace. Barbara Miller has joined me from Washington. Barb, quite the media briefing from Pete Hegseth. Let's start with this warship sunk off Sri Lanka. What did he have to say about that?
He said that the vessel had thought it was safe in international waters, but that it had suffered a quiet death. Now, he said that this ship was nicknamed the Soleimani, a reference to the Iranian general Qasem Soleimani, assassinated during Trump's first term. And he said, I guess POTUS got him twice. As far as the wider Navy was concerned, he said they were in the Persian Gulf. He said the Iranian Air Force was no more. And he said in a matter of days, U.S. and Israeli air forces would have total control over Iranian skies. So you get the sense this was really quite a sort of chest-thumping media appearance by Pete Hegseth. Let's just give you a little flavour of that.
Our rules of engagement are bold, precise, and designed to unleash American power, not shackle it. This was never meant to be a fair fight, and it is not a fair fight. We are punching them while they're down, which is exactly how it should be.
Yet Pete Hegseth was saying that this was very early days of this operation. He said that more and larger waves were coming. And when he was asked about this key question of how long all this is going to take, he said, you know, it could take time. It could be 3 weeks. It could be 8 weeks. So still no real sense. I guess perhaps that's understandable that the U.S. is not giving a sense of when this will end. It's just such a key question for an administration who said that it wasn't going to start wars.
And Pete Hegseth was asked about the reported strike on a girls' school in Iran. Talk me through that exchange.
Yeah, this was the BBC reporter at the State Department really pressing him on whether the US now knew it had struck that school with the reported deaths of more than 150 people, many of them young girls. Let's just come in where Pete Hegseth answers the question.
All I can say is that we're investigating that. We, of course, never target civilian targets, but we're taking a look and investigating that. Red tie in front.
Just on the basis that with the information you would have, your reconnaissance abilities, ability to gather information, I mean, it's several days on now. So is there any clarity on whose munition this was?
We're investigating it.
And briefly, just on another issue, he was asked about those reports that NATO air defences had shot down an Iranian missile headed towards Turkish airspace. He said, look, I'll have to get back to you on exactly what that looked like. But he said he did not think that that incident would trigger NATO's Article 5.
Barbara Miller there. Israel is demanding every Lebanese resident in the country's south leave their home and move north as it expands its strikes against claimed Hezbollah sites across the region. Tens of thousands of Lebanese have already been displaced in the last few days since Israel retaliated against Hezbollah for firing rockets in solidarity with Iran. But the dramatic development could displace many, many more people and came hours after the Lebanese capital was hit by multiple large strikes. Middle East correspondent Matthew Doran reports.
Beirut is being pummeled. From before sunrise, the Israeli military launched strikes across the southern suburbs, the area of Dahiya, often referred to as Hezbollah's stronghold. But this time the IDF went further afield too, hitting a hotel near the Lebanese presidential palace in Babda, a Christian area. The Comfort Hotel's owner is Alain Chabli.
At 4 a.m, they struck the hotel. We don't know why. We're still in shock.
The Israeli military says its strikes across Beirut and beyond have targeted the militant group Hezbollah, which entered the broader regional conflict 2 nights ago. As staff started the mammoth task of clearing the debris, local council member Sami Mamari explained their assessment.
Definitely we are in time of war. We fear that there might be some of these places that are connected or affiliated to Hezbollah. In this particular case, this is a hotel. They might be coming in and out without us knowing. We don't have that much manpower, but after that incident, we are working on it around the clock.
But Alen Chibli says his hotel has been housing people displaced as a result of Israeli bombing raids, and he has no knowledge of anyone connected with Hezbollah staying there.
Like everyone else, we heard what happened. It's strange because those who know us know we are not supporters of Hezbollah. We respect everyone, all political parties, but we're very far from Hezbollah.
The strike in Babda was one of many in Beirut, which came before a startling announcement from the Israeli military ordering the evacuation of the entirety of southern Lebanon, saying the whole area would become a target. The demand potentially displacing hundreds of thousands of people, although some living in villages are insisting they're not moving. South on the Israeli side of the border, phone alerts warned locals of incoming drones from the north ahead of a massive bombing raid by the IDF. In the Israeli town of Matula, surrounded to the north, east and west by Lebanon, the streets were eerily quiet. Local Yossi Weiss says he'd been going back and forth to his safe room for most of the day, with multiple emergency warnings coming through.
I'm sure that also the Lebanese do not want Hezbollah. They don't want them, just as the Gazans do not want Hamas.
Despite the danger, Yossi believes the current conflicts on his doorstep will be for the best in the long run.
It'll be good for the Lebanese people and for the Gazan people, and we all live together in respect and peace, and we'll drink coffee and enjoy each other's company.
This is Matthew Doran in Matula, reporting for AM.
Human rights groups have put the death toll in Iran at 2,400 people. It's hard to get information from inside Iran because of a regime-imposed communications blackout. But ABC correspondent Bridget Rollison has spoken to Professor Fouad Dazi, who is in Tehran and supports the Islamic regime.
Iran is targeting U.S. bases in the Persian Gulf and other legitimate military targets. We are very sad that this is happening, but we have no other choice. And there are some unintended hits when Iran is sending drones and ballistic missiles. Some of them are intercepted, and then the debris fall in places that Iran did not intend to hit. But if they hit them and if something else is hit, then that's not Iran's responsibility. Trump and Netanyahu started this war. Anyone that is killed, including Americans, the blood is on their hand.
Americans say that this campaign is ahead of schedule and it's taken out many senior figures. Is it time up for the Islamic regime?
No, these are pipe dreams. Trump has unified Iranians more than any Iranian politician could ever do.
Is Iran prepared to talk with the U.S.?
You know, Iran was in the middle of negotiations in June when Iran was attacked. This was a deception operation. Trump attacked Iran in June, calling the operation the Midnight Hammer. He took that hammer and smashed the negotiation table. Iran was generous enough to provide him with another negotiation table, and he bombed the second one. I think Iranians have run out of negotiation table to give him.
Professor Fouad Dazi in Tehran. He was speaking there to Bridget Rollison. Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney will deliver a highly anticipated speech to federal parliament today as part of his Indo-Pacific tour. Last night, the Canadian leader addressed the Lowy Institute, where he again claimed the international rules-based order is over and called on middle powers to band together when dealing with countries like the US and China. Political reporter Sarah Tomevska has more.
So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the Prime Minister of Canada.
Addressing the Lowy Institute, Canada's Prime Minister Mark Carney reasserted his view of a new world order in a speech that echoed his now famous Davos address.
Geostrategically, hegemons are increasingly acting without constraint or respect for international norms or laws, while others bear the consequences. If we work together in a variable geometry, in other words, different coalitions for different issues, we can do more than protect our sovereignty. We can build something better, more prosperous, more just than what came before.
Today, Mark Carney will become the first Canadian leader in nearly 20 years to address Australia's Parliament after talks with Prime Minister Anthony Albanese on the agenda, trade, critical minerals, defence and maritime security. Though Canada's prior interest in joining Pillar 2 of the AUKUS Defence Pact is no longer a priority, according to Canada's Defence Minister David McGuinty.
We'll see where it lands. Right now, we're very busy building bridges between Canada and other middle powers. Philippines, Korea, Japan, India, as I mentioned. We're here in Australia.
Events in Iran will also dominate talks, with both Australia and Canada among the first nations to back the US-Israeli strikes. Mark Carney yesterday conceded they were likely illegal. Director of the Lowy Institute's International Security Program, Sam Roggeveen, says it's unlikely Australia will follow suit.
I don't see there's an awful lot to be gained by Australia picking a fight with the United States over it. The rules-based order that Mark Carney pronounced the death of at Davos has always been a pretty delicate plant. There are certain elements of it that is in everyone's interest to maintain, and that will continue. But great powers have always been able to skirt the rules and just ignore them whenever they please.
Ben Saul is the UN's Special Rapporteur on Human Rights and Counter-Terrorism. He's urging Australia and other middle powers to take a stronger stance against what he calls naked aggression.
Because a world with no international law, with no rules, a world which is governed by the law of the jungle and might is right, is an incredibly dangerous place for all of us.
UN Special Rapporteur Ben Saul there, ending Sarah Tomevska's report. The war in the Middle East is also being fought online. Fake videos are rapidly spreading and it's shaping the public's understanding of the conflict. There are also fears that a cyber warfare campaign, which could affect critical infrastructure. Isabel Masali prepared this report.
It seems like a triumph of military strength. The clip titled "An Iranian Plane Versus a US Ship" has gained millions of views on the platform X. But it appears to be from a popular video game. Viewers who may have been fooled include Texas Governor Greg Abbott, who reportedly reshared and then quickly deleted it.
Video game footage, footage from previous conflicts, all that kind of stuff is easy to recycle and repurpose and recontextualise.
Dr. TJ Thompson from RMIT University explains it's not just video game clips. The scale and pace of this conflict, combined with generative AI technology, is making it harder to sort fact from fiction. As for those creating the content, he says politics and money are the two biggest motivators.
Get people to vote a certain way or to influence politics a certain way, muddy the information waters and make things more difficult, make people a bit more distrusting, cynical, disengaged, that kind of thing. That's kind of one big goal. Or the other goal is to try to make money from engagement and attention online.
QUT expert in Iranian disinformation, Dr. Ehsan Daran, says all sides are trying to control the narrative. But the Iranian side is probably the most deceptive and believed to involve a so-called cyber army.
So these are people who are hired to sit in an office-like space. Each of them controls multiple accounts on a social media platform. They follow the patterns of the day and what the regime wants them to do.
Beyond the misinformation battle, the cyber war has another possible front. The US Department of Homeland Security recently warned Iran-aligned hackers may conduct low-level cyber attacks, including overwhelming websites with internet traffic or malware strikes that can permanently delete data. Elliot Delis is from Cythera Cybersecurity.
Cyber weapons are comparatively fairly easy to develop and deploy. So the sorts of things that we may see targeted is entities like critical infrastructure providers and also as well key government institutions.
In 2012 and 2013, Iran was behind a massive attack that crashed websites, including major US banks. And as it fights this war, Elliot Deli says Iran may look to Russian attacks on Ukraine for its inspiration.
In 2017, the Russian government was attributed with an attack known as NotPetya against Ukrainian critical infrastructure providers. And that was used to attack the Ukrainian power grid, bus stations, gas stations, airports and banks. And that's the sort of activity that we might see as a result of a conflict like this.
But while Iran's military response has been clear, any cyber campaigns from it or its allies are yet to be confirmed.
Isabel Massali reporting with Angus Randall and Lucy Carter. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Melissa Clark.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. It's been less than a week since the war in Iran began, but already it's having an economic impact here. Today, Chief Business Correspondent Ian Verinder on why we're so economically vulnerable to a conflict so far away and what we can expect in the weeks ahead. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.